time for another edition of Otherwear, the program designed to help you get a handle on your hologram, where my guests and I hope to make you feel as comfortable as possible so that we can all collectively experience a wonderful influx of light in the form of transformative and, I think, life-changing information that we hope will remind you, your body and all of your cells of their idealized functions. As regular listeners will know, I have dubbed the term otherwear to describe anything that activates, enhances, or evolves our multidimensional inner technologies. And that is based on an understanding that our physical bodies and light body anatomy form a matrix of consciousness that can be likened to a biocomputer. Researchers into the genome have compared our DNA to a hard drive, and the cells operate in similar ways to silicon chips storing memory, etc. We have a spinal cord which could be thought of as the broadband connection to source information, and the central processing unit is of course the brain. But in order for all of this to work, you need to install the programs that run it, the otherwear. And this week, that is going to come from the focus of our show with Jane. We're going to find out that there's a new, yet ancient way to crunch numbers that makes it intuitive, easy, and fun. It's called Vedic mathematics. It works by stimulating not only our left brain, but our right brain, creating a whole brain state. And it's utterly fascinating. So even if you don't think of yourself as someone who gets turned on by the thought of the square root of 91, sacred geometry, or the phi ratio, I promise you, it'll be different this time. My name is Liz Miller, and I'm your host, and I want to thank you all for listening in to the live show and for all the excellent feedback I receive every week. The last show with Jaz Muheen, who has been living comfortably and surviving without food and just a little water for the last 13 years, certainly got a great response, and I highly recommend checking it out once it's posted on the archives here at bbsradio.com. Especially for the meditation exercise that Jaz Muheen was kind enough to guide us through, as it is a powerful technique and it will definitely kick in your body's ability to draw more sustenance from the prana or life force energy that is all around us. I have a great story too from during the week which is related to this that I thought I'd share. I finally decided, after living without a car my whole adult life, that it was high time I got my driver's license. So when I recently met up with my driving instructor, it didn't take us long to click, and as these things tend to happen, I found out that he is a descendant of a famous line of Romani gypsies, and his grandmother used to appear in royal courts on a regular basis. And although he has been highly psychic his whole life, he told me he'd been blocking it as he felt far too sensitive and it was really just too intense for him to deal with. So I told him about what I do and the show, and he asked to hear a couple of them. So I gave him a couple of CDs which included the interview with Jaz Muheen. And he rang me a few days later telling me that he'd listened to both shows about 6 times and was so inspired by Jaz that he'd been using that meditation every day and his appetite had definitely abated, but that he felt great. So now he's considering, quite seriously, planning on going on a long-term program to gradually cut out food altogether at some point in the future. So as you can imagine, I was pretty blown away. I love food and the ritual of food way too much to give it away completely. But one thing I got out of the chat with Jaz was that if you know how to do it safely, you can cut down on what you eat and supplement your diet with prana. And that's exactly what my driving instructor is doing now. Sounds like a bit of a plan. And just to reiterate what we said last week, this is not a path for everybody, so if you're considering it, you must have special training and quite a lot of preparation first. Now, if you'd like to find out more about the show or would like to get in touch with me, you'll find out about upcoming guests and my email address by clicking on the link to Otherwhere that you can find on the right-hand side of the bbsradio.com homepage. The show is going to be formatted a little differently this week, as the interview with Jane is going to be so interesting, I don't think that there'll be as many breaks for music this week. But the music I am going to play is pretty darn special, and sadly we won't have time for the guided relaxation and connecting our hearts in the web of love at the end of the program, but I do hope that everyone takes 5 minutes at the end of the show to just quietly go within and connect together in the web of love. And next week we will be doing an extra long relaxation session, so if you've never had the delicious experience of one of our Otherwhere meditations, I hope you join us again for that. Now, let's talk about numbers. Frankly, I've never been that good at them, but that hasn't stopped me from finding them terribly sexy. Call me Alison Dubois, but I find expert mathematicians and rocket scientists a bit of a turn-on. But that's because they're so good with numbers, and that means they possess one of the greatest keys to understanding our relationship to ourselves and everything else in the cosmos, and that is very cool. What is the square of 85? Could you tell me in an instant? There's a story by Manu Joseph at Wired.com about an Indian boy who's 17 years old called Kamlesh Shetty, whom, when asked to solve this problem, said without blinking, 7,225. The story goes on to say that he had used a trick from a quaint concept called Vedic math, a compilation of arithmetic shortcuts believed to have been written by ancient Indians who lived centuries before Christ, during a glorious period in Indian history called the Vedic Age. Its math has now crawled into the 21st century to further Shetty's dream of cracking a nasty engineering entrance exam. And for most Indian students, engineering is a calling that is most likely to take them away from third world realities to the shores of the good life. In top entrance exams, only 1 out of 100 candidates makes the cut, so quick problem-solving ability becomes the most crucial link between aspiration and fortune. Coaching for these exams is a multi-million dollar industry in India, but with almost every student equipped with such preparatory courses, the applicants search for something more. That's why several Indian students are beginning to get help from an ancient source, Vedic math. It has 16 brief formulas in Sanskrit that have been translated and interpreted into astonishing arithmetic shortcuts. Shetty did not know the original Sanskrit verses, but he did know how to crack the square of 85 in less than a second. He said, to find the square of any number ending with 5, just put 25 on the right-hand side. Take the number that precedes 5, in this case it is 8, add 1 to it, so then it becomes 9, multiply 8 and 9, you get 72, 7,225 is the square of 85. It's easy. Pradeen Kumar, who teaches Vedic math in Delhi, said there is an increasing interest among IT aspirants to take the help of Vedic math. One of Kumar's students, Kachik Arora, said, obviously Vedic math cannot teach you how to solve a problem, but it greatly reduces the computing time. I can vouch for the fact that in a 2-hour exam, I can save about 10 minutes using Vedic math. Sound interesting? Well, that's what we're going to be focusing mainly on this week on Otherwhere. We're also going to be talking about a few other things like sacred geometry and the ratio phi. Phi is a fascinating proportion that appears repeatedly in DNA and living organisms. It appears that this golden ruler is a common, if not universal, metric in the design of living organisms. and the teachings of most religions express the thought that part of God is within each of us and that we are created in His image. The pervasive appearance of Phi throughout life and the universe is believed by some to be the signature of God, a universal constant of design used to assure the beauty and unity of His creation. So when we return, Jane will be joining us on the line from the beautiful north coast of New South Wales in Australia to give us an expert's guide to Vedic maths and, quite possibly, the secrets of the universe.
On the line. There's a sky in the east, all the pyramids at Giza, where there once lived a girl, she ruled the world. Then down the Nile, he came with a smile. He was the king, she was the queen under the moonlight. Your eyes won't believe what your mind can conceive. Knights over Egypt, knights over Egypt, knights over Egypt.
From the Verse Beach, and you are listening to Liz Miller on Otherwear.
BBS Radio. Well, listeners, I think we are all going to have to prepare ourselves to have our views of numbers and mathematics expanded into realms we never thought possible. If you think that math is boring or that you're hopeless at it and the only way to learn is by memorising endless times tables and formulas that have no real application in your life, you may just change your mind after hearing what Jane has to say. Lecturer, teacher, artist and author of 12 fascinating books, beautifully handwritten in calligraphy and creator of 6 DVDs, this week's guest, Jane, spelt J-A-I-N, was born in Sydney to Lebanese parents and is a mathematician now living in subtropical Mullumbimby in Australia. He has enjoyed a lifetime involvement with the Fibonacci sequence and the 5 Platonic solids, which tap into the highly visual hemisphere of the right brain. His work with Vedic mathematics, a 2,500-year-old Indian system of mental arithmetic, empowers students to perform mental calculations, in many cases, quicker than a calculator. For nearly 25 years, Jane has taught and lectured in Australia and abroad, and as an authorised school performer, he has taught thousands of children through his travelling show Mathemagics. He has also worked with many gifted children, having taught at math camps and Rudolf Steiner and Montessori schools, universities and math conferences. All have employed him to rekindle the beauty of mathematics. People all over the world have expressed interest to study with him, and he's one of the very few people on the planet who can teach ancient knowledge to this level. So I feel very lucky to welcome Jane to Otherwear today. Hello and welcome to the show.
Hello, Liz. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to be speaking with you. I'm just thrilled that you're here with us because I feel it's going to be a very special show. And we've got a great deal of ground to cover, but I think that before the 2 hours are up, we will have clearly demonstrated that numbers represent, well, I believe, core creative vibrations in the universe, and that they encode a language which is full of magical potency, and that the person who understands that language can command tremendous power and communicate
at least a suggestion of the knowledge and wisdom of the universe. What do you think about that?
Yes, numbers are a key part of our lives. In fact, numbers are underpinning everything that we do in this modern world. The way we communicate, the way we ring people up, the way we have credit cards, the way we build a house, everything to me that I know of is structured on a comprehension of numbers. In the past, many cultures in the past, like the Tibetans and Pythagoras, they believed that numbers were more than just quantities like we think of them, actually thought of them with some special quality. Some numbers were anointed. But generally, numbers, they believed in the past, were living souls. They were a real thing. So sometimes certain number configurations, like things called magic squares, were actually living community of souls. So the history of numbers is fascinating, with every culture has an in-depth and original way of perceiving the universe. The way they described the universe was in terms of numbers. So our job today is to restore that, the way numbers have been tainted, because my journey around the planet has shown me that a lot of people are disappointed and dissatisfied with mathematics. Of all subjects, mathematics could be perhaps the most prized subject as a sign of intelligence. But unfortunately, 95% of all students I meet have shut down from mathematics. So this is what has happened. We need to restore that original divinity and start teaching children the symmetry of numbers, which has put me on a journey.
I know, it's put you on a journey for more than nearly 25 years, yeah. Is that right?
That's right. Actually, I did work. Some people like myself have a natural inclination in the left brain to understand the logical data about what numbers and mathematics represents. But most children, we find, like about 70% of all children, aren't in their left brain. They're actually in the right side of the brain, which is all about patterns and shapes and colours and sounds and music, all that kind of stuff. So we need to start approaching children on their level and how they learn numbers. Children would love to learn mathematics through a visual arena. That's why suddenly DVDs are becoming important. Like, I'm a writer of books, and I find that I've spent all my life writing books, but in the last 5 years I've realized that most people are buying DVDs now, mainly because our society has become a bit lazy in this technological era. But people can sit back in their lounge room and, through the visual medium of a DVD, actually learn about Vedic mathematics or any new subject that they want to learn. So that's what shocked me, is that people are wanting to learn, but they want to learn through the right hemisphere of the brain, which is pattern recognition, which to me is the definition of what we're going to be talking about today, is that this subject, Vedic mathematics, is a universal language of shape and pattern recognition, which doesn't make any sense now, but we will talk more about that, because I believe that the future of all technology on the planet is based on shape. It doesn't make much sense, but when you look at, say, something like a Star of David, you know how we have two interpenetrating triangles?
Yes.
Symbol for Israel, for example. That we need to look at symbols as three-dimensional shapes, so that's really like two pyramids going through one another. So
yeah.
That Star of David is really what we call a star tetrahedron. But the star tetrahedron, the two pyramids, one going through each other, interpenetrating, interdigitating pyramids, it's really the atomic structure of a crystal. And if you join all those eight vertices of those pyramids, what you get is a cube. So we know generally that crystals are cubic, right?
Yes.
But we can also say, from what science has taught us, that crystals store memory. So when you're working on your computer, you know that all the data, the 0-1 binary analog, it's all stored in the crystals, the silicon chip. So the atomic structure of the silicon chip is a certain shape. That's the key word, is that the shape stores the memory of all this infinite data when we're making movies and writing books. It's all stored. So my research shows that shape stores memory. So at the moment on the planet, there's a lot of interest and renaissance in sacred geometry, but if you're really into sacred geometry, what if we could use all this language of shape that we all read about and we're excited about? But the truth is, we've got to be able to do all our mathematics through shape. Now, I believe that one day in the future, the new technology, like the language of light and the language of shape, will be operating even the keyboard. So right now when we do data, we push on a keyboard to get a result. But in the future, I believe by visualizing the letters A, B, C, or even beyond that, visualizing symbols, we'll be able to even operate computers, cars, everything. So that's what I'm seeing as a future, because the language of shape and pattern is a universal phenomena. We all have it within us, but it's a lost science. We've forgotten how to really access all this knowledge that is part of our energetic field. So I like to talk about the rediscovery, because it's never been lost. It's there. It's in our field. So we need to learn how to even do mathematics again, because the way we're doing it now is just so clumsy, and it's sort of tragic how children are shutting down and not enjoying a mathematics class.
Well, I can remember what I was like when I was at school, and I was a very bright student. I actually loved going to school, but when it came to maths, especially once I got into high school years, I just found the methods of teaching it were so dry and uninteresting. I just couldn't, you know, spend the time on it, and I felt that really, even if I learned all of this stuff, how would I even use it in my life? I couldn't see any practical applications for some of the stuff I was learning. And so, of course, you know, you have a brain that wants to be stimulated that isn't being stimulated. In fact, it's almost being atrophied because there's so little interest there in what's being offered. I really, you know, just as soon as I came across the information about Vedic mathematics, which I actually found through an article that you wrote in Nexus magazine in 2003, that first time I was exposed to this whole new world of numbers and understanding numbers, it had kind of corresponded with a time in my life when I was also studying the Mayan calendar very heavily. And so I could see all of this resonance between the two different systems. So much of it just felt right. And that's because this is in us, like you just said, and I really want to explore that during our conversation, exactly how our bodies are actually in resonance with the, you know, underlying mathematics of the universe. And it's such a huge subject, but I think that if we can just scratch the surface of it a little bit during this conversation, we're going to be able to give people so much to go on, to take away with them, to think about over the coming weeks. And I know that we will help transform their thoughts and feelings about traditional Western maths and numbers, you know, much more than that, about numbers themselves. And let's get into some of those ideas about how the ancients saw numbers as representations of qualities, or they had symbolic mental meanings as well as visual meanings.
That's important, because the definition, just for those people who don't know what Vedic mathematics is, just the general definition is that the ancient rishis from India about 2,500 years ago, they could calculate every mathematical problem could be done mentally in their head. Everything that we can do on a calculator can be done mentally in their head. So it's known as mental arithmetic. But there is a clause that says if we can't do it in our head, we can do the mathematical operation in one intelligent line of operation, one line of working out. So it really needs to be demonstrated at some point. But just for the viewers, Vedic mathematics is called mental one-line arithmetic, and it was based on 16 sutras or formulas. So that's what we're going to be covering over the next hour or so, just those who don't know what Vedic mathematics is.
And just briefly, before I get you to give some examples of how great you are as a human calculator, let's just tell people about the Vedas and about this body of knowledge that Vedic maths has emerged from.
Myself, I'm a builder by trade. My father came from Lebanon, and so all my life since a child, I've always been building houses, so I had to always do mental calculation. But this concept of building a house or a temple or a structure is one of the four main Vedas. So what we're talking about today mathematics, or the Ganitas, actually comes under one of the four Vedas called Stapatya Veda. So Stapatya Veda was the mathematics of engineering and calculation and structure. And basically everyone had to know these four Vedas. So the other Vedas, the one that's most popular now is called Ayurveda, which is the Indian way of healing, diagnosing through plants and herbs and crystals and massage. That's called Ayurveda. It's very similar to like sort of Chinese medicine, but Ayurveda has become very popular. So people had to know all about the medicinal qualities of sesame oil. So basically everyone was like their own doctor. There's no such thing as a Vedic mathematician, because everyone had to know these four Vedas. Like there's the Vedas of music, there's the Vedas, which other subjects? There's the Ganitas, which is mathematics, astronomy. People, like if you were going to get married or do have something special in your life happening, you would want to consult your local Jyotish, who was the astrologer. So people had to know also about the cycles of when Saturn and Jupiter were conjuncting, and that's when they were going to start their new business. It was auspicious. And there was a certain sacredness or ceremony attached to everything. So people lived very holistically, and they also had all this knowledge. So the four Vedas of astronomy, music, mathematics, healing, everyone knew it. So you could never just say, I'm a Vedic mathematician, because you are also a great scholar, which is what they call a pundit. So, you know, like the Vedic mathematics master that I'm going to talk about, by the year 1900, his English was far better than ours. He studied all his Hindu culture, he studied the English, he studied science, physics, metaphysics, many things. So as part of the stress of the Western world today is that we're suddenly in an age of acceleration where we're starting to need to master all these disciplines. It's like it's all in our soul, and we need to force ourselves now to even learn business, to learn about fasting, to learn about the Mayan calendar and other cultures. It's all quickening for us. But I believe the transition is happening now, and that's why suddenly, for example, people are interested in, well, how was mathematics done? You know, how did the Indians, the 2,500 years ago, these Indians were in the region of the Hunza Valley, were doing remarkable mental calculation. At the same time, at the time of Jesus in the Roman culture, we were doing mathematics by the primitive Roman numerals, which are like worlds apart. You can't even really multiply numbers with the, you know, the Roman numerals.
Yes.
You learn to feel like I, V, X, B, D. They all represented like 1, 5, 10, 50, 100. They couldn't multiply. So you could see that this stream of knowledge from the Vedas, actually they claim that this knowledge came back about 1,200,000 years ago. That could be like the next question. What is the Vedas and where did it come from? Would you like me to talk a little
bit
about that?
Yes, please.
My definition or understanding of the Vedas is that it's the totality of knowledge. It's the illimitable or the unlimited storehouse of all knowledge. So some people may call it the Akashic Records, which is kind of like a living or spiritual library that basically there's a record of all experience, history, even emotions that we've had of all our many lives and of the history of the planet and even the solar system. So the Vedas actually go right back to the Bhagavad Gita, and there was a book that preceded that called the Rig Veda. The Rig Veda is meant to be the oldest known scripture, and they said that in the beginning there was only mathematics. Like there was a concept of the construction of the universe, you know, maybe from the point became the line, became the triangle, became the square, became the cube. You know, there's a geometrical origin of the universe. But in the Bhagavad Gita, most people know that the story about Krishna and Arjuna. And Arjuna was on the battlefield with Krishna, and Krishna was given Arjuna all this wisdom. And basically what he says, there's a chapter in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, verse 1, it's sort of explaining the origin of the Vedic knowledge about 1,200,000 years ago. And it says that Krishna said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god, Vivasvan, and Vivasvan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed it to King Ikshvaku. So what that means is that the Bhagavad Gita goes into detail to say that this secret knowledge of the gods that came from the sun god Vivasvan, was the way that it got to the earth, was that this original royal confidential knowledge of Vedic mathematics and Vedic physics, all this origin of the electron and the creation of the world, came from the sun, the king of the sun called Vivasvan, right?
Yes.
And then Vivasvan in turn gave it to Manu. Manu was like his son, so Manu was like, you know how we, the Christians, have Adam and Eve? Well, Manu was like the father of mankind, or the first human. So this sun god delivered all this royal and confidential knowledge, like Vedic mathematics, to not just the earth, to Manu on earth, but to all the kings and queens on all the other planets. It's a very cosmic history. And then Manu on earth, he gave it to the first king, which was his son. He gave it to the king Ikshvaku. And then that's how we got this, the Vedas. The Vedas, they say, were written on the rays of the sun. That is a beautiful transmission of this knowledge. But what happened was, over time, there's different epicycles and cycles, and they're saying that in this age of Kali, which we're in, it's like a trough.
Yes.
The knowledge got forgotten.
Yes, actually, before you move on, I just want to quickly mention that Kali is one of four ages.
That's right. Yes.
So could we just quickly explain how we're in the age of Kali now?
Yeah. The age of the sun, for example, there's a golden age where, let's imagine, in a golden age, we could imagine that everyone had their full spiritual prowess or powers or natural abilities, like we could all be telepathic or we could all just move through the air, for example. There may have been a golden age where there was no resentment or bitterness or greed, but unfortunately, you can see now that we're not at a crest, we're sort of in a trough where we're polluting the planet, where all people are stealing and corrupting, and, you know, so this is, we're at our lowest, and it's called the age of Kali in the sense that Kali represents, it's like we've gone to sleep, but slowly, slowly, I feel like we're just coming out of this trough, because slowly, slowly, we're all questing, we know that we're all living a lie, and that we have to do something to, you know, change the path of mankind as we're going on a path of destruction. And that's why the education's important now, because our vision, what we're talking about now, may take generations. Because, I mean, my vision or my mission statement would be that I see a race, the next generation of children doing mathematics all in their head without the electronic calculator. So I would say there was a time when we had all this natural ability. There wasn't even anything psychic about it. So I believe, you know, we are still in this age of Kali, but I am in no way an authority on all of this. I just, I've done several visits to India and I've studied with many people, but I'm more an authority on the Vedic mathematics. But the interesting thing about this subject is that I have never, when I went to America three times, everyone said, but who's your master? Which Vedic master did you study with? And invariably, I often say, well, I never studied with anyone. I remembered this knowledge. And that's what put me on a world tour, is that people are saying, but how do you know all this knowledge on the Vedas? And how did you know all this knowledge on Fibonacci and the secret meaning of 108? Like, no Indians know why 108 is sacred, even though they worship it. Yet, I've discovered it mathematically through the Fibonacci sequence in nature. So that put me on the world map, because suddenly, just by mere remembrance, which is what I was talking about, that shape stores memory, when we tune into our third eye, which is a crystal, we have the ability to access all the records, because we are, I believe, the living human computers. And that's what the Vedas are really saying. Like thousands, millions of years ago, when you read the Bhagavad Gita, they're saying that they had all this power.
Well, let's talk about the power that you've been able to embody, mathematically speaking, through Vedic mathematics, and give people a demonstration of what you can do.
Okay, well, just for the listeners who don't know anything about Vedic mathematics, let's just say what we're aiming to do is to get children off the electronic calculator, because what that is, we first of all, I'd like to praise all mathematicians and praise all technology, because we do need the calculator and the technology, but what's happening is we're giving all our power to it, and it's an external Merkaba. Merkaba means the unification of polarities, in a sense that allows us to travel through time and space. So a Merkaba, people would define as, say, a light vehicle. Okay, but what's happening is that every time you put the heater on, in winter when you put that electric heater on, you're giving your power to that external technology in the heat, because we've forgotten that we can generate our own internal power. So I'm fascinated by the physics of internality, and Vedic mathematics is about us doing all mathematics from within, not relying on the calculator. And I'm not against the calculator. I'm just saying it's making us lazy, and we've adopted a clumsy mathematical system. So what I'd like to teach to people who are listening is that, imagine if the teacher said to you, say you're a builder and you've got a big floor, it's 108 feet by 109 feet, and this is a practical example, you want to know how many tiles will I need if I've got to multiply, say, 108 by 109. And straight away, like most people would get their pen and paper out or the calculator, but what if you could just in 1 second actually see the answer in your inner mental screen? So I'll speak it out and explain what I did. So 108 times 109 means I hold those numbers in my inner mental screen, I hoist the 8 and I hoist the 9, because I'm going to do something with those two excesses. My base is 100, but 108 is 8 more than 100, and 109 is 9 more. So I add one excess to the other number. So I add 8 to the 109, which is 117. I have to learn to hold that 117 in my consciousness while I do another operation, which is I'm going to multiply those two excesses, the two numbers that I hoisted, the 8 and the 9, I multiply them, which is 72. So now I've got my answer through a picture. So the answer is 117/72, which is, say, 11,772. Now, that took a minute to explain, but when you actually do it as a mental operation, it's literally at the speed of thought.
Okay, so if people out there have a pen and paper handy,
yeah,
it might be a good idea to grab something now.
That's
and you can do some of the sums along with us.
We can do a few other examples so they can write it down and have a look.
Yes, and also I've got a couple of examples up on the web, so people who are listening can go and find those by clicking on the Otherware link from the bbsradio.com homepage, and you'll be able to actually visually look at some of the sums that we're discussing. But more on that later.
In essence, my work, I'm currently in the Byron Bay area and I teach children. And the fascinating thing that's been happening here in my local area, which may interest some people because it came as a surprise, it wasn't planned, was that more adults were starting to want to do the course than the children. My vision, as you know, is for children. But what happened was here in Mullumbimby was that every child that came, also their parent came along. So now I'm teaching all parents and children together. So they're all couples. Couples as mother and daughter, father and son. And it's fantastic because suddenly now the parents are recognizing that they need to take an active participation in their child's education. And it's interesting that it is learning Vedic mathematics, but you should see the parents actually get more excited than the children in the class. And because the children, the parents are actually carrying a heavy wound, like when you started this program, you said something about your memory and the pain of mathematics. Well, a lot of the parents, some parents have tears in their eyes because they're suddenly waking up to the fact that they learnt mathematics the wrong way. And I'm not blaming any teachers, I'm just saying that the good-meaning teachers out there have failed to educate the child visually. So suddenly the parent, I see myself now kind of like a doctor of mathematics, because it's interesting what's happening in this classroom, and I'd love to get it all on DVD to teach people this relationship, a parent and a child.
Yeah, you know what I love about it? I love the fact that the parents are not having to catch up to their children, and the children are not having to catch up to their parents. They're learning simultaneously new knowledge. And
what's interesting is that the children are quicker than the parents. That's what's amazing.
The father's
lifting up his eyebrows going, wow, my son just multiplied 108 times 109 like in 1 second, and the father's only just getting it. But the son, the children are natural. They get it.
Yes,
they understand.
There's a quote actually from Krishna Chittaji, the rediscoverer of Vedic mathematics, because we do need to explain it. It went away for a long time, and it's really just started to come back into popular usage since the late 1800s. He is quoted as saying, on seeing this kind of work actually being performed by the little children, the doctors, professors and other big guns of mathematics are wonderstruck and exclaim, is this mathematics or magic? And we invariably answer and say, it is both. It is magic until you understand it, and it is mathematics thereafter.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's one of my favourite quotes.
It is such an incredible quote, and it really explains why your website is called Mathemagics as well, and why your travelling show educating the children is called Mathemagics, because it would seem to be like magic. And I think some people do accuse Vedic maths of being parlour tricks.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Vedic mathematics is based on 16 universal formulas, and another teacher like Bharati Krishna Tirthaji, his name is the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and he's teaching people and children to meditate upon these 16 sutras. What are the engines that make these sutras work? What is it that makes rapid mental calculation possible? And it might be an X-shaped symbol which looks like a magnetic field, or when you look at the top-down view of the DNA helix, is also an X shape. But these X's, like two diagonals, are the hidden invisible secrets on what makes a sutra work, how we can multiply 15 squared in 1 second, because there's a diagonal relationship between numbers. So it's looking at the real relationships that's not just in numbers, but it's in everything. It's in the human body, it's in the home, it's in commerce, it's in the stock market, it's all. So that's why Vedic mathematics is becoming popular, because it's about life as well. And I've actually got a quote here from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. He's the one that people know as the Beatles guru, and he never talked about Vedic mathematics, but he's like an Einstein. He's probably he's still alive, and he would be like the greatest male mathematician on the planet, but he has no ego, but he can calculate better than a computer. And he says here, this cosmic manager, the cosmic mathematician, is eternally free from mistakes. The cosmic mathematician is present within everyone. It is the light of life of everyone. It is present within everyone in the structure of the Rig Veda and the Vedic literature. It is the light of pure intelligence. And I love that quote too, because it's really pointing our finger back to our third eye to say that within the center, the third eye is a crystal, and it's the point in between the two ears. And if you drew a line in between your eyes, right in the center of your brain, there is this little gland like a marble, and it's a crystal. And that's that point where when we meditate and we center and we go still, something within us lights up. And it's all there. Everything is within us. And it's our duty, and it's a mental discipline that every day we find stillness and time to tune into how much we do really know. And even when I teach the parents and children, I like to do a little meditation before we start and dedicate the lecture, because this is sacred mathematics. It's sacred knowledge. It's lost knowledge. And that's my thing, is about giving gratitude, because we always stand on the shoulders of those before us. We don't own anything. Everything is public domain. But I just love the fact to know that it's all within us. And that quote from Maharishi says that this light of life is in everyone. It's really special. We're not learning anything new. We're just remembering this knowledge.
Yes, remembering is definitely a key word for these years. And I'm sure that there are people out there listening to this now who are really feeling what you're saying and understand it on a very deep level because they are remembering. And more people everywhere are remembering. And it's a very special time for all of us who are able to shed a little bit more light in these areas for those who do want to remember.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Otherware. We're talking about Vedic mathematics with Jane. I'm Liz Miller, and this very beautiful piece of music you can hear underneath me is truly one of the most brilliant songs ever written about obsessions with numbers. In this case, the ultimate obsession, pi. Taken from the 2005 album by Kate Bush, Ariel, this is undoubtedly one of Kate's finest moments.
Thank you.
Ode to Pie by Kate Bush from her latest album, the first in over 10 years, Aerial. It's out on EMI in the UK and Australasia and Sony BMG in the US. And I want to give them a big thanks for their kind permission to play this on the show. And back to our conversation with Jane, who is an internationally known expert on Vedic mathematics, sacred geometry, and the Fibonacci sequence. Is there an agenda in place to keep this sacred information out of circulation of mainstream society? And if so, why? We'll be exploring that question and getting deeper into sacred geometry in just a moment when Otherware returns. This is bbsradio.com and I'm Liz Miller.
Downloading Otherware.
Let's go on and give people some examples of rapid mental calculation. So I would like you to demonstrate live, and this is without any planning, the following multiplications.
Okay, right.
And
I'll be ready.
Okay. All right, so what's 19 times 15?
Okay. Can I speak it out, the answer, so that people can work out how it's done?
Yes.
Okay, so 19 times 15 in my head is I add the 5 to the 19, which is 24. It's 24 lots of base 10, so that's 240. That's half my answer. I need to add to the 24 the multiplication of the 5 times 9, which is 45. So the answer is 240 plus 45 is 285.
Correct.
So that is a one-second thing. Normally, that answer, when you create, define the inner mental screen by putting, we're just learning how to hold the memory of 19 times 15 in our screen, our inner screen, and then just by being the pattern, because I said this is the language of pattern recognition, as soon as I have 19 and 15 in my screen, I raise the 9 and I raise the 5 because the sutra that's operating here is called by the excess. So as soon as I do one little step, like I raise the 9 of the 19, I raise the 5 of the 15, the answer just falls down like rain. Like when they asked the Rain Man, actually, this idiot savant that could do absolutely complex calculations, they said to him, how do you do these amazing these things that we can't even do on a calculator? And he says, I see the answer. So that's what Vedic mathematics is. And that's a good example you gave me, 19 times 15, because the essence of what I'm teaching as I'm going around the world, the name of my program, it's called Mathemagics for Teens. Because if a child can do 19 times 15 or 13 times 18 or 12 times 14, if you can do any teen number doing that simple process, you can do anything that's thrown at you in Vedic mathematics. That's the essence, because you're learning how to hold those digits. So that's one of those sutras. So the same thing is, for example, if I said to you, what's 1,009 times 1,005? Instead of going 19 times 15, let's go to base 1,000. But as soon as you say, what's 1,009 times 1,005? I hoist the 9, I hoist the 5, like I raise it up on a flag, and then I see the answer. The answer now is, there is no mathematics, it's just a visual experience. I add the 5 to the 1,009, so that's 1,014. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's half my answer, 1,014. And I'm going to tag onto that the multiplication of 9 times 5, which is 45. But it must be a 045 because I'm in base 1,000, which has 3 zeros. I must have 3 digits on the right-hand side of the slash. So the answer is like 1,014,045, like that. So I'm doing something in the millions, all because I understood a picture. That's the essence of what we're doing. We're doing mathematics by an appreciation of patterns.
So okay.
That's all it really is. And it's quicker than a calculator. If you've got someone on the calculator to say, what's 1,009 times 1,005, we just say it in 1 second while they're even typing it in. And what would happen if the battery on the calculator is gone? Well, you can't even do any mathematics. You know what I mean?
Yes, that's right. We're doing this because My radio show is called Otherware, and Vedic mathematics is a perfect example, and one using Vedic mathematics is a perfect example of how we do have these incredible inner technologies. Our abilities to recognize shape, for example, and then derive mathematical solutions from those shapes is a really amazing ability that we have that hardly any of us use. So the aim of this program is really to demonstrate how we are all capable of doing this. We are all really human biocomputers. We're much more than that, of course, but it's one way to look at how we function. So, Jane, are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. 27 times 24.
Is, let me see, 3162, 648.
Yes. Okay, I was a little quicker than you then.
Okay, yeah. There's actually a few little steps happening in my brain.
Yeah, I know. I'm probably not making this very fair on you.
I'm reasonably good at Vedic mathematics because I'm actually deeper into other subjects like magic squares, Fibonacci, but I've just come back from India, and I can assure you that my two friends that we're going to bring on a national tour, Kranti Kiran and Gaurav Texiwal, who I met in India just last year, they will give you answers literally at the speed of thought. Whereas because I'm a Westerner, remember, I haven't had any teacher. Whereas these boys have been trained, you know.
Yes, I understand.
But I can assure you that when we come on our national tour in Australia and overseas, we'll have the best in the world to actually show you. And they're not gifts of God. They're shareable. They can teach you everything. Okay.
That's exciting. Okay, so let's get into some higher numbers. What's 93 times 97?
The deficiencies of 93 is 7. The deficiency of 97 is 3. So I take 3 from the 93 is 90. That's 9,000. And multiplying 7 and 3 is 21. 9,021.
Brilliant. And what about numbers above 100? 108 times 112?
That would be 12096.
Yes.
I don't know what it is, but it's 12096.
1,002 times 1,013?
Times 102 times 113 would be 11526, 11,526.
Okay, I got those same numbers, but with some zeros in the middle.
No, it shouldn't be.
Okay.
You want to check?
I'm going to check that again. 102.
Vedic mathematics is infallible, so it can't be wrong.
013.
Can you check that it's 11,000?
No, I've got 1,015,026.
Aren't we in the hundreds? 102?
No, I was in thousands then.
Oh, so you're in the thousands.
I was in the thousands.
I did 102 times 100.
Ah, brilliant. Okay, so that's a really great example of how you can just... You can see the relationships between the base 100s and the base 1000s.
Yeah, so give me another 1,000. Sorry, I didn't do it. Let's do the 1,000 again.
Okay, 1,002 times 1,013.
Is 1,015. That's 1,015,026.
Correct.
That's right.
That's amazing.
It's beating your head instantly, but it takes time to speak it out, so it's quicker. It's really mathematics at the speed of light.
Mm.
It's very quick. But these are numbers that are only near the base. What happens is that some of these numbers, if you said to me suddenly, like, well, what's 23 times 81? Those numbers aren't near base 10 or 100. So the yogis had to invent another sutra, which has another name, like vertically and crosswise, which is still a picture, to solve all known multiplications. So the ones we're doing are easy because they are what they call near a base, like base 1,000, base 1,000,000.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start giving numbers that are in different areas, like 23 times 81, I would have to do a diagonal relationship with the numbers. So 23, say, times 81 would be 3 on the end, 16 on the left. So then I cross multiply, which is 1 times 2 is 2, plus 24 is 26. So I would get 1,863. Can you check that? 23 times 81 is 1,863.
I'm sorry, what were those numbers again?
We're doing 23 times 81. We're doing numbers in different locality.
Yeah, I've got 1863.
Yeah. So that took a little bit longer because it wasn't in a second. That may have taken like 3 seconds because it involved a bit more mental calculation. But you definitely can do it all in your head and no paperwork. And there's another sutra in the end when you learn the 16th sutra, but the main one at the end is called by mere observation. You get to the point, it's called by mere intuition, where you just look at something and you see the answer. And the best description of that would be doing cube roots under a million. So if you would like to take a two-digit number, say any number like 28
yes.
or 92,
yes.
a two-digit number, I want you to cube it.
Okay.
I want you to cube it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you what we call the cube root.
Okay. And can you tell us what the sutra is here?
The sutra here is the highest of all of them because it's called by me observation.
Right.
By mere it's really observation through a pattern.
Okay.
But on another level, it's called by mere intuition because when you give me those, say, 5 or 6 digits,
mm-hmm.
I close my eyes, I type the numbers into my screen, and what I'm doing is I see a pattern.
Okay. So let me give you these numbers.
Slowly for me.
5, 9.
How many digits
do
we have?
This is a 5-digit.
That's 5 digits, yeah.
5, 9, 3, 1, 9.
Okay, it'd be 39.
Yes.
Oh, no, sorry, 29.
No, 39. Oh, you were right the first time.
Yeah, see, what happened was doubt came. So I did it in 1 second, but then the doubt came in.
Yeah.
Can we do one more just to get it right?
Okay, about...
That's quite remarkable that as soon as you say it, the answer just appears. It's, I mean, that's what we mean by mathematics at the speed of... Speed mathematics at the speed of light. It's just so instant. And my people think that's magic, but if I was to sit down and show you what I did through a picture, you would go, oh, that's so easy. That's what the master said, that quote.
All right, yeah, let me give
another
you
one.
Let me give you a 6-digit number this time. 274.
Yep.
625.
65.
Yes.
65. So that's literally quicker than, that wasn't even a second, that was literally as soon as you said it, the answer appears. And that's what I'm teaching children. That's why we call it jaw-dropping sutras, because it's like, wow. But beyond the wow factor, it's just pure mathematics. It's the original vivisection, what the Vedas talked about, saying this was this secret and confidential knowledge. So imagine, you can see why the politics in the world, that imagine if suddenly every child that came out of school was a genius. You can imagine the political nightmare we would have, there would be a revolution. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's not just awakening mathematics, it's awakening your third eye consciousness. And so that's why, as a visionary, I believe that the future for me is teaching, you know, teenagers, because in the next generation or two, even though we're teaching mathematics, they're going to be the peacemakers, they're going to be the leaders.
Yes.
Because they're just infused
with
this divine knowledge. It's like, how else... How can they become corrupt politicians, you know?
Absolutely. It's a subject that I've focused on the show a couple of times before, and I can't wait to talk to you about some more of the experiences that you've had with the kids that you've taught. But I really want to keep going with some of the sutras, because there are a couple of sutras that are used quite often, more often than others, vertically and crosswise is one of those. Could you explain how that works?
Okay, if everyone who's got a pen and paper out there, if you can write down 12, and then under 12 put 13. So we're multiplying, say, 12 times 13.
Okay.
Right? And what we're going to do is we're multiplying all numbers like that through a picture. The picture, if you can draw three symbols, draw, like going from left to right, draw a vertical line, a big X, like a cross, like a X shape, and then another vertical line. So this sutra is called vertically and crosswise. So I've got those numbers in my screen, 12 and 13. What I'm going to do, I know it's going to be a three-digit answer. So under 12 times 13, where you put your bar, the line, put three horizontal dashes, because that's going to be the answer.
Okay.
So what we do now is we say vertically on the right means I multiply the 2 times the 3. So I've got 2 times the 3. So on the horizontal line where my unit digit goes, I'm going to put 6.
Yep.
And then we can go to the extreme left where the 1 and the 1 is. And we say 1 times 1 is 1. So that's vertically on the left. But in the middle, in the middle of 12 and 13, you can put a tiny little X that joins the 1 and the 3, draw a line between the 1 and the 3 and the 1 and the 2, and you'll see that there's that those two diagonals are from the 1 to the 3 and the 1 to the 2 forms an X shape.
Yes.
Which is the origin of, like, have you ever thought, where does the symbol for multiplication come from? It comes from the diagonal coming down from the top 1 down to the 3 and the bottom 1 going up to the 2.
Yep, so we can actually see the roots of some of the maths that we do today in Vedic
math.
Yeah,
the origin of the symbols. And so what I'm going to do now is called cross multiplication. This X factor means I multiply 1 times 3 and I'm going to add to that 1 times 2.
Okay.
So 3 and 2 is 5, so I put 5 as the middle digit.
Okay.
So now your answer should be 156.
That's right.
So that's what the master, Bharati Krishna, he said that of all the 16 sutras, the most general, practical and useful of all the 16, the one that we use every day in the supermarket, for example, would be this one called Vertically and Crosswise. And it's a very, very special one. And the good news is actually you have in your, because you're from Victoria, there is a school in your area that I visited. I think it's at Hawthorne in Victoria.
Oh, the Erasmus School.
The Erasmus School, yes. And there's about 300 to 400 students, and they're all learning. They've got rid of the British curriculum, and they're only learning Vedic mathematics. And it's become so popular that I heard just recently in the last couple of weeks that that quote that I spoke of about Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, well, they've expanded a school in that same area of Melbourne somewhere too. So when we come on our national tour, we would love to come and visit both the new Maharishi School for higher consciousness. They're actually teaching consciousness. Isn't that amazing?
It's wonderful.
These children are learning about consciousness and meditation and Vedic mathematics. And
it's the way it should have been
the whole time. Yeah. But it is happening, you know, so I'm very positive. I know there's a lot of distress in the world, but when I look about slowly all the changes that are coming and happening, I really do have hope for the world, you know. Because, well, we can't judge any politics that's going on, you know. There's a reason why it's happening, because it's really empowering people to make the changes. Because if
right.
we don't make the changes, then we just become sheeple.
Yeah, unfortunately, human beings have this tendency to wait until their backs are right up against the wall before they create any changes. We've really created a lot of situations in our world where we have got our backs to the wall, and if we don't start taking action, we're not going to have a planet.
I mean, Mahatma Gandhi was one person, and just one person's pure conviction was enough to change the world. That's just amazing for me when I just even look at Gandhi's life, that one man went through so much suffering, but he believed so much that he had to go on that path. It's just so powerful.
Yeah,
and we're all capable. We're all Gandhis.
We are. So one of the other sutras that I really loved was the one that helps you calculate multiples of the number 11 because, well, number 11 happens to be one of my favourite numbers, but it's also so easy to see how when you work with this sutra for calculating these multiples of 11, how simple and how, I don't know, it just seems like it's not even, you don't even need to use your brain that much, really. So let's talk about that one. What's that one called?
That one is another sutra, and it's called Digit Sums or Digital Sums, but I have given it another name. I prefer to call it Digital Compression because later on, like, digital compression means, you know, when in numerology people say, you know, your birth date, all the numbers of your birth date might add up to, like, 34.
Yeah.
And then you compress 34 by adding the digits, you say 3 plus 4 equals 7. So that's kind of your lucky birth number.
Correct.
That's actually one of the sutras of digital compression, but it's being demonized. It's interesting that this very important concept of adding digits, which people say, oh, that's not mathematics, that's just mean numerology, it's been given bad press. But one of my lectures that I give around the world is called The Demonization of Sacred Symbols, because this very thing of giving numerology a bad name is actually the key to cracking all the code. Because if you were to look at a sequence in nature called the Fibonacci sequence, which is the numbers of growth that go 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8. I keep adding the previous number. 5 and 8 is 13. Then I add the 8 to the 13, it goes to 21. If I compress this infinite series of the Fibonacci numbers, or doing compression, I suddenly get a series of numbers that also goes to infinity, but it recurs. It has what we call a periodicity of 24. So there's 24 recurring numbers. Now, if you were to add up these 24 numbers, the numbers that they add up to is the magical Hindu anointed number called 108. So the living mathematics of nature, of the pentagram, of the flowers and the distances of the planets from the sun, they all obey what we call the divine proportion. It's a bit like the book that Dan Brown wrote on the Da Vinci Code. It's really all about this fascination for the divine proportion, why the Mona Lisa was drawn in a ratio of 1 is to 1.618. Well, when we look at it in whole numbers, we find that the underlying pulse or rhythm of the universe that I can see mathematically, and because I've got X-ray eyes, thanks to the 16 sutras that I know and adore, I can see where all the patterns lie, and the pattern of the living mathematics of nature is based on a hiccup or a rhythm or pulse of 108, 108, 108, and it's tangible and it's right there, but they've kept it secret and hidden, and it was hidden in the pentacle. So you can see why now that the witch hunt happened. Millions of women lost their life if they mentioned about healing powers or the pentacle, which Pythagoras' symbol was the pentacle. And they hid this knowledge. The Indians, because of the persecution that's gone on for ancient knowledge, they hid it in a song. So the Indians redeemed all this knowledge by encoding it into a mantra. It's kind of like a chant for enlightenment. It's called the Gayatri Mantra. So the Gayatri Mantra has 24 syllables in it, and the 24 syllables, which is a chant, it's repeated 108 times. Now, what in the universe has 24 and 108? Well, it's the Fibonacci sequence, that whole fascination. Why is the whole world suddenly fascinated about the Da Vinci Code? Because it's in our ancient memory. We know on a deeper level that there's some truth in proportion and the harmonies and the cycles of DNA and the planets. It's all there, but we have to work through the fear. So what happens is that when the people that control the world put fear around certain subjects like the pentacle, the swastika, the Star of David, all this stuff, the fear denies access of the memory within
you.
Absolutely
right.
So that's why we have to become fearless. Like, you're a leader, I'm a leader, the children are the future leaders. Well, the real power that we have is that we know the truth of who we are, but we're going to be challenged and tested, because it's like stirring an ant's nest, and we have to become fearless like Gandhi and just say, look, this is the truth of mathematics. I refuse to teach my children the British curriculum anymore, because it only reaches a certain level, and I want my children to be unlimited gods of creation. So I'm going to pull them out of this school and put them in a Vedic math school. So this is where the power becomes localized. We have to locally, in our own home and schools, bring the change. And if we want a global change, we have to start learning it ourselves. And that's why at the beginning of this talk I said I was really pleased that something happened that I didn't plan, because it's all part of a bigger scheme that the parents are all doing my class with their kids now. And I thought, wow, this is bigger than I thought, because this is what we really want. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So I get carried away.
Oh, that's okay. It's wonderful to hear how passionate you are about the work that you're doing and how you can see it's transforming people in the world.
Well, passion is the key, because if you remember, like, if you were, like, 5 year old and there was a boy that you loved when you were 4, you had a crush on someone at kindy, well, imagine the reason why you can still define every single little feature of that person's face is that you were in love. You had an interest in that person. And that's the same thing, that when we have passion, we are so enthused and interested that we can remember every single detail. So that's why I believe that passion is the key. And I only want to work the teacher training courses I'm doing now, if I can duplicate this knowledge, is I only want to work with passionate people, because the word enthusiasm, the C-O-T-H-E-O, enthusiasm, was a Greek word for God. So when someone is filled with this God, this enthusiasm, the power is just magnified 100 times. So that's why my job is to make mathematics beautiful, because if I can get a child to be enthusiastic about their numbers that they're doing, then that's going to change the world, you know. But if there is no enthusiasm, if the teacher's just in class every day doing the same boring curriculum and they're half bored just doing it because they're just doing it for pay, but they're not doing it for passion, then what's the point of doing that? So that's what I'm questioning. Like, I honour all mathematicians because it's their star language, but my point is, are we really teaching them the highest level of mathematical consciousness?
I am interested in finding out about what the response has been like from the education system to Vedic maths. Do you find that there's a lot of resistance there, or...?
I often go into a staff room where there's, say, 10 to 20 maths teachers. They've had a busy day and they've heard about Jane's doing this mental calculation. So I get half an hour in the staff room. I turn them on, I get a handshake and they say, thanks, but you don't expect us to be teaching this. And I'm saying, yes, I do. And they say, oh, we can't rewrite the books. It's going to cost us. We're not going to learn all these tricks. They're just a bag of tricks. And so they accept that there is a better system. That's the good news. But the practicality of actually shifting has to happen up at government level. Schools are going to do what they have to do, and we accept that. But it's up to us to make a change and create a possibility where interested parents can say, yep, I would love my son to do an eight-week course and learn about mental calculation because it sounds exciting. So that's what I think is the resolution at the moment. Like, there's no conspiracy, there's no judgment, just we have to create the change. And I mean, people like me, I renunciated a medical career. I was going to learn medicine, but I ended up living with Aboriginal people for 2 years in New Guinea, and I learned more about mathematics study and how flowers grow and vines spiral around the palms, and all that observation in nature was my teacher.
Well, nature is one of the best teachers there is.
That's great. So my vision is to have the school where we sit out under the trees like they did in the old days. So these visions of this image of a yogi sitting under a tree, when they were chanting something, say, like, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, when they were chanting these amazing codes or mantras, right, they were actually reciting high-level mathematics. Like, most people know about pi, P-I. P-I is the relationship of the circle's diameter.
Yep, to the circumference.
Circle's diameter is 1, then the circumference is 3.14. Right? Let's just say that's a general fact, even though that's not true. That's another subject. Because pi is a lie. There's another... that's a dysfunctional harmonic or value that they've given us. But let's just say the pi relationship is 3.14. Well, the ancient rishis, when they sang songs like Gopi, Gopala, they were actually reciting pi to 32 decimal places all through song, which I think is amazing that the transmission of ancient knowledge was an audio experience. They recorded advanced mathematics through the mantra, through the song, through the teacher-disciple relationship. And we've lost that in our culture. And I think that's why suddenly there's a big interest in the Vedas at the moment.
Yeah.
I just did a trip to Malaysia. I got invited to see the Prime Minister's chief advisor, and I sat with him for half an hour, and he was very excited. But he opened up my eyes, and he said to me, Jane, we can't even use the word Vedic because we have Muslims here and all sorts of religions here, and people would shut down if they heard the word Vedic. So what that aroused in me, what he was teaching me, was that we have to find a name that's universal. There's it's a universal mathematics. It's actually beyond the Vedas, because other scholars are saying, well, the Indians just didn't invent the zero. We believe that the Babylonian culture before them was using advanced mathematics, which look at our clock, when we see if the time is 3:45, it's space 60. We're using 60 seconds, 60 minutes, and that was what the whole Babylonian culture was, based on 60. So we are right now using the memory of a Babylon system, but they also had a zero as well. So who invented the zero? Like, we know it wasn't the Arabs. The Arabs just came in and conquered. The Ottoman Empire conquered India. But India is quite amazing, because India seems to have been attacked by so many cultures, but it seems to magically absorb the perpetrators. I mean, India is a fascinating place. I've been there a few times, and I'm just fascinated how it just keeps pulsing and it survives all the attacks. And right now, India is shaking off like a dragon that's waking up. It's shaking off the British curriculum, because that's the tragedy in India, is that there's all these children, and they're learning our system of mathematics, which is defective, and they're just realizing, oh my God, our own antiquity, our own archives from thousands of years ago says we have the best system in the world.
And so,
that's what Bill Gates employs. 40% of all of Bill Gates' mathematicians are from India, because they're just naturally swift and amazing calculators.
Mm. And what has the response been from Indian mathematicians to your presentations? You're a Westerner, and it's like selling ice to the Eskimos, isn't it?
My first visit, I just went around to sacred places, but the second visit just last year, thanks to the two teachers I mentioned before, Gaurav Tekriwal, who does Vedic Math Forum, and Kranti Kiran, who was a walking computer at the age of 14. Well, they hosted me and got, you know, we'd teach 1,000 students a day, so that was good. But one day we got to teach at a place called Infosys. So Infosys is, let's just say, it's like Microsoft. So here I am in the building. Kranti, well known, so this guy just flips his fingers and gets a room full of 400 mathematicians, right? All the office workers.
Wow.
Running Microsoft there, but it's Infosys. And I got to give my lecture on 108 on Vedic mathematics, and they were stunned. They're saying, how did this white boy Westerner here, how does he know all this stuff on the Vedas? And I introduced the concept of 108, because they all know about 108 in their culture, when they build a Vedic altar, it'll have 108 bricks, and, you know, everything is 108. And then I explained the Fibonacci sequence. We compressed it with that sutra of digital compression. And anyway, at the end of that, I got my first standing ovation. That was probably a highlight in my life, that my first real response was to the elite, the mathematical elite of India in Microsoft, stood up and applauded me. I thought, wow, this is there's more to this Vedic mathematics. So that's why there's a huge renaissance in India. They're saying, we've got to begin teaching our children ASAP only Vedic mathematics, because, you know what, if they continue to do it, in 5-10 years, India is going to lead the academic world, because if we continue for the next 10 years using the electronic calculator, have a guess what's going to happen to the global brain?
Where I think it's going to shrink quite a lot, isn't it?
That's right. So I'm very interested in watching what's happening in America, what's happening in India, and what's happening in Australia. So it's growing in Australia. We've got two schools now. It's just really exciting. So
it is exciting, actually. A good friend of mine has his daughter at the Erasmus School down here, and he told me months and months ago that she was learning it, which probably planted the little seed in my head to get in touch with you, and that she was absolutely loving learning Vedic maths.
They learn Indian dance, they learn Sanskrit language, they learn meditation. I would love to come to Melbourne actually very soon just to revisit. And they're very proud of me, because I'm going around the world saying, hey, there's this school called Erasmus, and they're beaming, you know, and they're all supporting one another. I could be anchored here in a school, but I think my job as a pioneer is to sort of go out and sort of raise this flag and say, hey, there's another system. So at least I've let another 10,000, if not another 100,000 people know that there is another system.
Yeah.
That's my job, is just to wake up.
Yeah.
You can let your listeners know that early in 2007, I'm currently organising one or two teachers from India now, the best that we have in the world, to come and do a 7-day retreat. So if anyone in your area in Melbourne, it'll be an international conference, but if anyone in Victoria is really keen and they want 7 whole days, it'll be like a teacher training. We're going to make that available, and that's why I appreciate your show, because the ability that you have to educate and promote these new concepts, it makes things happen, you know. So I need all the support I can get, because I'm doing this just out of my passion and total dedication. And, you know, we need people that can sponsor, to bring out the teachers who are willing to sponsor. If someone is willing to sponsor, they can always just get onto my website.
Can you tell people where that is, please?
Okay, my website is www.janemathematics.com. So it's J-A-I-N and Nathamagics is spelled NathemagicsCom.
And now, friends and tastemakers, let's have a listen to a brand new release from Kerry Chandler, who I've mentioned on this show before, is one of my very favourite producers. And this is just out on Max Trax via Topless Records in France, and it's called The Machine. And this one is going out to a very special friend, Rob, in New York City. I know that you're listening out there. It's wonderful to have you along. Thank you, my friend, being you. When Otherwhere returns, we'll be concluding our interview with Jane. But next week on the show, stay tuned, we're talking to Starfire Tor. We're going to be talking time travel, time shifts, time slips. And that's with Starfire Tor from the ID Interdimensional Yahoo group on the internet. We are going to have a lot of fun, so please make sure that you're back online same time next week.
Listening to the radio, searching for thought-provoking topics to listen on, I check into Otherwhere from bbsradio.com with Liz Miller.
One of the greatest things I think about Vedic maths for me, and just what I've kind of discovered through learning about it, is that we don't really think about what happened in the past with calculations, but through, well, on every continent virtually, we have structures from ancient civilizations that are obviously constructed with advanced mathematics in mind. All you have to do is look at the Parthenon, for example, or the pyramids at Giza, the incredible sites down in Mexico around Teotihuacan, etc. And there's an obsession with numbers and mathematics, form and shape, that you can almost feel coming off the bricks. And so what it's been really amazing for me is that I've sort of realized, well, how exactly did they make those calculations? They didn't have calculators back then. They must have been using some other method. And Vedic maths has to have been that method or something along similar lines, do you think?
Well, some people would call that the super science in ancient India, A lot of people have heard of things called the Vimana.
The Vimanas, yes, the flying machines.
Spacecraft. Like when we were talking about Bhagavad Gita, they were describing celestial battles going on. So when you're reading about all these celestial battles, you're talking about spaceships and beams of laser beams destroying other spacecraft. So this is all being described in the Gita, you know, the Bhagavad Gita. And so we know for a fact, because there's scholars that I've been meeting as I travel around the world, that are actually talking about these amazing Aryan race, the ancient Aryan race that knew the element fire, was seen from their, like, astro weapons. They called them astro weapons. And there were flames that were belching like missiles. There was advanced missiles of light and fire, but it was all described in these shastras. I'm trying to remember the name. They call it like the Vimanika Shastra, where they described all these ancient flying devices of India, and they were made from very special metals, but the science and the mathematics that created these spacecraft, which I believe were on advanced Mercury propulsion systems, was high-level Vedic mathematics. And so that's a good question. Like, it's always been there. Where did this knowledge come from? So I can't answer that, but I just know that there's a Dr. Pinotti who's made an exhaustive study on the history of Indian astronautics, and he describes many texts like the Samangana Sutradhara, which is just many, many stanzas of how they actually built the spacecraft. Like, it's all high-level mathematics. So, but the thing is, this is all like out-of-print stuff, and it's been kept. I believe what's happened is that the Vatican, which controls the world in a sense, the Vatican has stolen and kept hidden all these books, these rare books that describe the truth. And while I remember, before we forget, the master Garati Krishna Tetaji, who lived from 1884 to 1960, he actually made a 7-year retreat. And in that time, he reconstructed and collected all the lost knowledge of the Vedas, like for thousands of years, you know, how they could recite Pi. So he wrote 16 books on the 16 sutras. The only book, there's one book called Vedic Mathematics, which is now number one bestseller for non-fiction in one public. The people that published Vedic Mathematics, it's a number one book, thanks to people like myself and many others talking about it. And so what happened was that he wrote 16 books, but the knowledge got stolen. What happened was the master was invited to go to Los Angeles to teach in California. And this was the first time that a master, in fact, he was more than a master, this man, Garati Krishna, was actually like the Pope, the Roman Pope. He was actually a head, one of the spiritual heads of one quarter of India. And there's rules for brahmacharis. They're not allowed to cross the water. Some strange rule that says, you know, you're a yogi, you just hold consciousness in the Himalayas and you don't travel across the water.
Okay.
Well, he crossed the ocean to go to Los Angeles because he had a vision that to raise the consciousness of the planet, he had to disseminate the teachings of the Vedic mathematics. So he went to Los Angeles, and they also filmed him there, and he took the mathematical world by storm, went on TV, radio, university, institute. But what happened was that all the film literature has been stolen. We believe the Vatican stole it. All the books that the master wrote that were back in India with his disciples, they all got pilfered and stolen. We assume the Vatican they just basically store the knowledge because they don't want it out. It's too powerful. And I know that for a fact because the latest research shows that NASA, in the field of robotics, what we would call simulation of the brain.
Artificial intelligence?
Yeah, artificial intelligence, that's the word I was looking for. We know for a fact that NASA are simulating, how does the brain really work? And they're using these sutras. They're using Vedic mathematics because they know it's the most intelligent and sophisticated system, not on the planet now, but for thousands of years ago. It's always existed.
Yes,
but
actually,
the mathematics of unity consciousness, because when we talk about base 10, 100, 1,000, a million, get rid of all the zeros and you're always left with one. So when we're doing this rapid mental calculation, it's really based on unity consciousness. So you can't get any higher than one. It's all based on this vibration of one. That's why it works and that's why it's infallible.
Mm.
Which reminds me, but you should ask me now, because you were going to ask me about multiplying by 11 before we detoured talking about ones.
Yeah.
You can see how this is, even though it's just Vedic mathematics, it's a huge subject. It just opens up so many other doorways.
Yes, yes, it definitely does. And there are so many questions that I have no idea how I'm even going to get to during our time together because, you know, there's just so much to discuss. Okay, so let's go on to talk about the sutra for calculating multiples of 11.
Right.
How does that work? And what is the sutra for that particular calculation?
The sutra for multiplying by 11 is called digit sums. The digit sums means whenever we multiply by 11, like say we're going to multiply 25 by 11, we literally just add the digit. So we say 25 is 2 plus 5 is 7. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the 25 and separate the digits. We're going to like an elastic band stretch out 25, so it's the 2 base 5, and in the middle, in between the 2 and the 5, we add the digit. So 2 plus 5 is 7. So the answer is a 3-digit number, 275. A lot of children already know that. Some teachers are very excited by that one already, but that's your best example. If you had to teach someone...
Okay, can I just quickly get you to demonstrate how we would do that then if there was a 9? In the middle there. So just say we did 39 times 11. You separate the 3.
Yep, okay, so separate the 39. So there's a 3
space and the 9. Yeah.
We're going to add a 12 in the middle. But the thing is, we're only allowed to have one digit in the middle there. So that the 1 of the 12 has to be carried over.
Okay.
So it's going to be 400. Yeah, 429. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. So could you just explain that again, exactly how you carry over the 1?
Okay, I'll go over that again. So 39 times 11 means I stretch out the 3 and the 9 because I want to insert the sum of 3 plus 9, of the two digits in the centre.
Okay.
So in my inner mental stream, what I have is I have 3, 12 and 9. But I'm only allowed in the middle to have one digit. There's a two-digit number 12 in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So the little one, we call it a baby one, has to slide over to the left to add to the 3. So the 3 becomes a 4.
Right.
Makes it 400. And what remains, remains. So we've still got...
49.
Yeah.
So how about you shoot me a multiplication of 11 and I'll try and work it out in my head.
I'll give you an easy one and a harder one. So if I said to you 26 times 11...
Okay, so that would be 286.
That's it, 286.
Yeah. Okay, that was really easy. Give me another one.
I'll give you one where the sum adds up. If one where the sum adds up more than 9. If I said to you 38 times 11...
Okay. So we stretch out the 3 and the 8... And then we add 3 and 8 together, which is 11. We move the 1 over to the 4, to the 3, which makes it 4, 1, 8.
That's it. So the 1 and the 8 just remain. They're unchanged. It's only the 3 becomes the 4. That's 418. And that's your best example. So if someone heard this show and they said, I've been listening to Vedic mathematics, and you had to describe it to someone who knew nothing about it, that would be your best example. Multiplied by 11 is the ultimate definition of mental one-line calculation. It's a one-line answer, and you can do it in your head in seconds, and it's based on pattern recognition, just doing it very simply through shape. So that's what I keep talking about. The language of shape is the future technology. It's an inner technology based on shape.
You know, I love that whole idea because our DNA has a particular shape.
That's right.
Our bodies have particular shapes. The features on our face are placed in certain areas. And when you look into the mathematics of where our eyes are placed in relation to our nose and our mouth, for example, or how the shape of our fingers is determined, you find out that everything in nature, including our bodies, follows the phi ratio, or the golden mean, which is 1.618, etc., etc.
That's right.
And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about this, because as you were saying earlier, you know, with shapes being the future and how so much new technology is actually relying on this understanding of shape technology to create new things. One of those things is nanotechnology. And nanotechnology has taken some pretty huge leaps and bounds over the last few years. A lot of the new nanotechnology devices are being made by mimicking the way our DNA replicates itself. Do you know about this?
I know a little. I'd like to hear more about what you met this speaker.
It's pretty amazing stuff. Basically, there's a method, and I'm just trying to pull this out of my memory banks now. It's been a few months since I've had a look at this material, but basically there are new ways of constructing things using, absolutely tiny, tiny, tiny molecules joined together. And they're following the same sequences that our mathematical paths or relationships that are in our DNA. So the DNA has actually been a sort of template for the nanotech designers to copy so that they can then use the same principles employed by our DNA to replicate things at very, very tiny, tiny lengths, and it's just amazing. So what this is suggesting to me is that when you understand sacred geometry, you understand shapes, you're actually understanding the real foundational building blocks of life and of creation, and that if there is then this underlying building block of life, doesn't that then suggest that there has to be a designer,
that there has to be
intelligent design, that there is a harmony, a symmetry, that there are just so many beautiful interrelating mathematical relationships in our universe that this can't be a coincidence?
There is no coincidence, because that's what mathematics teaches me, that it's all symmetry. If I said to you that when you talked about 1.618, the Fibonacci numbers of nature, we know compresses down to 24 recurring digits, which all adds up to 108, 108. But what's this fascination for 24? And you can say, oh, that's interesting, we've got 24 hours in a day. I wonder if the ancient people used this knowledge of nature as a stargate for time travel. And if 24 was important, like it is, it's part of our clock, it's our time, fourth dimension. But if I said to you, look, there's many mathematical recursions that are based on 24, then you'd start lifting your eyebrows and say, yep, there's a definite symmetry. So we can take another sequence of numbers. Most people know this series. There's a series of numbers called prime numbers, for example. Most people know a prime number can't be a prime number like 7 or 11 or 13. They can't be divided by any other number except 1. So there's a whole series of prime numbers. And you know what mathematicians are teaching us? Mathematicians are saying, oh, it's a nonsense sequence. There is no symmetry or harmony in the prime numbers. It's infinite nothingness, right? But have a guess what? If you were to plot all the prime numbers on graph paper, like in a spiral, like if you start with 1 on the middle and then you go 2, 3, 4, like a spiral around it on graph paper, thanks to the age of computers and technology, we can take those, we can go up to numbers in the millions and billions, and when we reduce the image that we get that are prime numbers, it looks like a rose flower. So the series of prime numbers, thanks to the world of technology, which is the opposite to nanotechnology, we can see that prime numbers form a flower-like shape. And what I wanted to say too was that another important discovery to show that there is a sequence, there is symmetry to the prime numbers, which makes all the books wrong, is that imagine a clock of 24 hours. So imagine your circle, and you're starting from one up, draw a circle and put 24 points on it, like a clock of 24 hours, and just go from the top and go 1, 2, 3, 4, going round. Right?
Yeah.
When you get to 25, I want you to begin, say, another series of keep going, like do another circle, concentric circle, go 25, 26, 27. So we're just writing all the natural counting numbers, but in a sequence of 24. So when you get to 48, you begin the next 24, you go 49, 50, 51. You just can go infinitely, right?
Right.
Well, have a guess what happens is that suddenly, if you were to investigate where's all the prime numbers,
yes.
suddenly find that they all line up on what we call four crosses. You know the ambulance symbol? There's like a red Maltese cross?
Yes.
Do you have that symbol in Victoria, red
yeah.
sort of?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, you know what that is? Like I said, I'd like to talk about the origin of mathematical symbols. Well, that Maltese cross is known as a Templar cross, and it's actually the fourth-dimensional Templar cross. This is advanced, high-level mathematics. So all the people who control the curricula, they say, oh, the prime numbers are nothing in it. The reason is that we know that prime numbers, when they get into the billions, trillions, and zillions, are the secret to military encryption of guarded information. They don't want you to know that there's symmetry and pattern in the prime numbers. So I'm just outraged that we're teaching our children all this deception about numbers. So that's why children shut down. They don't see it. But what I'm trying to say to you is that if the Fibonacci numbers can show infinite pattern based on 24, and then another famous pattern of prime numbers is all about 24-ness, it's like everyone should start opening up their eyes and have a look at this four symmetry. Every sequence has a pattern, and I can show that and prove that. So there's a lot to show. So Vedic mathematics is only just one subject. There's a thing called galactic mathematics, what we're talking about now, the Fibonacci sequence, the prime sequence, the binary code, all of these. Like when you draw up the binary code, you know the binary code of doubling numbers, like 2, 4, 8, 16, 32?
Yes.
If you were to convert the binary code into a picture on a 9-point circle, what the shape that you get is the VW symbol. So that very symbol that you see, VW.
Really?
You look at the Caltech symbol, which is the pentacle. All the logos of the top multinational companies in the world are based on these amazing sequences. So they're dumbing us down. They're saying, oh, there's no sequence or symmetry in any of this. Just do
however, they're using them.
It's all there.
And right in plain sight, too.
That's right. Well, this is what we call, now we're entering another summit. This is what's called Masonic knowledge. They know all of this, and that's why it's always been guarded and kept secret. But I'm going against the grain here. I'm saying we no longer can hide this information. It's in plain sight. It's visible. It's tangible. And the children are all shutting down. If we want a government, an intelligent government, we have to change the mathematics. And I can confront any teacher, and just say, look, this is the evidence. Children respond and adore to know that there's patterns in the binary code and the prime numbers, and they get enthusiastic. And so I'm armed with all this knowledge. So in the 7-day workshop, it will be mainly Vedic mathematics, but I just want to let you know that it's not just Vedic, because Vedic is only one culture. We're entering a time now where we need every culture in the world to adopt a universal language that we all agree on. Let's say people are always going to be speaking Russian and French and German, they're all conflicting and they're all different, but we want one language that we all agree on, and I believe that the universal language is mathematics. Really?
Yeah, well, everyone who has ever been taught anything about numbers has probably been told at one stage or another that everything in the universe can be distilled down into numbers to be understood purely as numbers. So I totally agree with you there. I'd love to take this to the next level, which is about the language of shape and how closely related shape is to numbers. And of course, sacred geometry is something that we've touched on already during our conversation. But could you tell the audience, what is sacred geometry?
Well, the word geometry, geo means the earth, and metri, as you know, means to measure. So originally geometry was about the measuring of the earth, and there was a relationship thousands of years ago where people studied the cycles of Venus and the moon, and they realized that their life here on earth was a connection to mega cycles, the biggest cycles in the universe. So sacred geometry kind of evolved around the patterns that appeared as, say, Venus was going around the earth. So over 8 years, Venus displayed a distinct shape known as the pentacle, a five-sided shape called the pentacle. And in a sense, the word sacred or sacré is not correct, because, ultimately we know that everything is sacred. And so I just see it as a relationship to the bigger picture, and we're the smaller picture, and that there is no separation of this knowledge, that it's all out in the stars. I believe all this stuff is in our DNA. So sacred geometry really keeps bringing us back to ourselves and to the back to the garden, because all sacred geometry I know is in observation of the flowers. Someone did a research, I remember his name in a minute, but one amazing teacher just studied insect antennas. He had 200 photographs of all the insect antennas in the microcosm, and then the completion of his work was to show that, well, all the antennas that we have in our technology, we're all in the insect world. Every single antenna we have constructed is one of his actual photos of nature. And that's
how
what
amazing.
I've forgotten his name. I mean, Dan Winter did an interview with Professor Halley, Professor, I'll remember it in a minute. But there's so many amazing teachers and their work's not known.
Okay, and what are the main... we know about 5 platonic solids and we hear about 13 Archimedean shapes. Yes. What does that mean?
Okay, well, basically, it's all the mathematics of what we could call sphere packing. Imagine I said to you, here's a sphere, right? So another ancient puzzle, like the magic square was, well, here's a sphere. What shape fit inside the sphere, where every line is the same length, every angle is the same, and every face is the same? So imagine now in your hand you have a cube.
Right.
So in one hand you've got the sphere. But one of the 5 platonic solids, the answer to this is that there's only 5 shapes in the universe that obey this definition. So imagine a cube in your hand. You can look at it and say, yep, I can see that the 8 corners of the cube touch the sphere.
Right.
The 6 faces are all equal. And every line, the 12 lines that make a cube, if you had a wire frame, the 12 lines of the wire cube, yep, they're all one unit length. So that's the definition of so the cube is a platonic solid, which is really the silicon chip molecule. It's like a crystal. It's inside the star tetrahedron, those 2 pyramids we were talking about, has 8 points or vertices. So if you joined all the vertices, you get the cube. So crystals prefer to pack cubically. So that's one shape. If I took the 6 midpoints, the 6 faces of the cube, if I was like a spider and I went inside the cube and I wanted to join my web from the 6 centers of the 6 faces, if I went to the middle center of each face and drew a shape, the shape would be what you call an octahedron. So the octahedron also has has 8 triangular faces, every length is the same, and it fits in a sphere. And the others, but they're all based on what we call the square root of 2, which is fine. But the other shapes that I'm going to talk about are based on the Fibonacci sequence. That's why they're the real mysteries about time travel, is that the other shapes all have a length of 1.618, or the reciprocal of that. So the other shape, if you start imagining shapes like the soccer ball, it's not actually the soccer ball, but if you imagine in your hand now you have a soccer ball, well, that's called a dodecahedron.
Yes.
Which has 12 pentacles. So base 12 is really the measuring stick for the universe and the pyramids and Stonehenge. And the complementary shape of, if you were a spider and you're inside those 12 pentacles and you join the centers of those 12, you would get the inverse known as the icosahedron. Icosa is a Greek word, means 20 triangles. So they're a pair, they're an eternal pair, but they're based on this mystery of the human body, the human canon, which is all 1.618. Like when you look at your fingers, you go from your fingernail to the knuckle to the whole finger to the palm. It's all increments of what we call the divine proportion. But that's what the 5 platonic solids do. Those 2, the icosadodeca, are an infinite series that allow us, as we keep stellating one of the shapes, if I took a shape like a soccer ball and put pyramid points on it, I stellate it, it makes, it transforms alchemically into another shape. So the dodeca, when it's stellated, makes what we call the icosa. And then when you stellate the icosa, it makes the deca. So what it means is that there's only one frequency in the world that allows us to go from the microcosm to the macrocosm by this 1.618 frequency, and that's the divine proportion. The secret of that, what we're talking about, 2 of 108, is is that there's only one frequency that does it. If you stellated the dodeca at the midpoint and just said I stellated at 1.3 or 1.8, it wouldn't work. So only when you stellate a shape at 1.618, which is the mathematics of DNA, only that allow you to time travel or to literally turn metal lead into gold. That's what the alchemy was all about, that the ancients knew a secret, and it was based on a harmonic, which is the mathematics of flowers, DNA.
Yeah.
And it's all in the planetary cycles. We know all this.
They're
the five shapes. So what I would like to say about the sphere, the ultimate thing is the ultimate Merkava or light vehicle is the sphere. Now, if I asked you another puzzle, I said, here's the sphere. How many spheres can pack around the central sphere? So imagine now you've got maybe 20 oranges on the table and you've got one orange in your hand.
Right.
And so you're trying to pack all these other oranges around the central one. So this is the puzzle. How many oranges would pack around that one orange, assuming they're all identical?
Mm.
So have a guess, for example. Like, is it 6, 18?
I wouldn't have a clue. Okay, I'll say 24.
Okay, well, it's close, but the answer is, say, 12. So only 12 oranges. So imagine now you've got one in the middle with 12 around it. So that's a code. That code is called 1213, because when someone like a Jesus or a Muhammad or Krishna has so much love, they expand and they get 12 disciples, right?
Yeah.
So that's what we call 1213. But that shape, if you were a spider and you went inside and connected 12 centers of those spheres, you get a beautiful Archimedean solid called the cube octahedron, which literally can transform and make all the other shapes. So there's only one shape in the universe that when you collapse it, it makes all the other shapes. It literally transforms shape. And that's the key to atomic structure. And what they've done is they've demonized all this knowledge and they won't teach this in the universities. There's huge forces stopping the revelations of the platonic solid symmetries because it's all compressing back to 12 and 24.
Right.
These are very important numbers, but the numbers are honored as shapes. So when we see numbers as shapes, that's the higher level of mathematics that I'm really excited about. And what I'm trying to say about George Bush now, that Leave No Child Behind program, what they're trying to do now is they're trying to phase out all geometry, because geometry is your visual cortex. And if they phase out geometry, have a guess what? We're stuck in the left brain.
Wow. That's
what I'm on about. That's why I'm on a world tour, because we need to teach these solids. And in the Master's book, in Bharati Krishna's book, that Master, where they all the books got stolen, he said on his last page, when he wrote an introduction to the one book that exists, he said, well, this is only one of 16 books. All the other books were about the Fibonacci sequence and the platonic solids. All that knowledge has been hidden and withheld. And that's when I realized my destiny, because now all the Indians studying Vedic mathematics thinks that it's only Vedic mathematics, but they don't know what Fibonacci is. They don't know the five platonic solids.
But you do. You've been able to pull all of this information together
and you can see
a much, much bigger picture, can't you?
And the thing is, I have remembered the knowledge. That's the distinction about my last work, is that I have never had a teacher. So that's the people are saying, oh, but who's your master? I'm saying, there is no master. You are your own master. So in India, they call that Anahat Guru. Anahat Guru means your heart is your own guru. Because I'm a definite example. I can prove that I've never had a teacher. And in Lebanon, when my father took me to Lebanon, I had certain experiences where when I was 21, I went to a remote mountain monastery to visit someone like John of God. We had a character by the name of Mar Sharbel.
Right.
His name's Mar Sharbel, and people from all over the world. He died 100 years ago, but people from all over the world would come to touch his stone granite tomb and claimed miracles, a bit like the Fatima thing going on.
Right, yeah.
And a bit like John of God. But anyway, so I went there when I was 21. I'm currently 48, so a long time ago I went there. And I went to that monastery, and to cut the story short, I'm coming back from the monastery after I said my prayers. And there was a stone on the road. We're driving down this 8,000-foot mountain. I started falling down a cliff. So here I am. I'm only 21. I'm falling down an 8,000-foot cliff. And I thought, this is the end of my life. And then anyway, a miracle happened. The miracle, well, this is the first part of it. The first part was a stump of a tree magically stopped the car from rolling further down. But the miracle that happened for me and my cousin at the time was that when I got out the car, which was destroyed and we weren't even scratched, my friend went to get help, the car was wrecked, and I went back down the slope of the cliff and I looked down at this car that's just about to roll over, and I thought, this is amazing, look at this tree stump holding this wheel. And then I saw something on the ground by the tire where it happened, and it was a picture of that saint. and that's the miracle. I've just submitted that, you know, 30 years later to the Marshall Society, because the Roman Catholic Church have just ordained him as a saint, because there's stories like this all around the world. I don't know if you know John of God, but it's the same story.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
But I had this personal experience when I was 21, and that's when my life changed. That's why I couldn't continue on with university. I had to go travel. I thought, there's something more to life. If this remarkable story happened to me, I need to go on a quest. So that's why I went and lived with Aborigines for years, and that's how my story started. And I've got other stories like that, but there's three major stories where I should have died, and that's why how I know that, in a sense, I'm guided, I'm naively guided on my path to be protected, because my mission, you know, is to teach children this lost knowledge, this ancient knowledge. And in my own naive and humble way, without any teachers or masters, I'm just, I guess the masters are within us, you know, the invisible world. But whatever the spectacle is all about, we just really have to just follow our passion. I believe, ultimately, when we follow our bliss and our passion, you are unstoppable. And all the friends of growth that you need to manifest your dream, just you magnetize that to you, you know. It just naturally comes, because we're not asking anymore. Because ultimately, in the end, the laws of higher consciousness say that when you hold in your third eye the shape, this is why I'm talking about mathematical shape, when you can visualize what you want to manifest in your life without any dialogue or words or logic, you only hold the visualization of what you want to create, then you bring the future into the now. And that's the secret of manifestation. It's all about holding the shape clearly and coherently in your inner eye. And that's why if we do our mathematics from the inner eye, we're teaching the children how to manifest and create.
Yeah, we sure are.
So that's why I think it's so profound. And but you can't have any ego, because by the same laws of magnetism, if you have any ego or deception, it's all going to be magnified. That's what the pyramids mean. The sacred geometry of the pyramid means that if you have a good heart, your goodness will be amplified. And that's why I found the ashes of many dead people in the pyramid, was that people who went in there for greed or whatever purposes, they just literally burnt up into ash, you know what I mean? Because the frequency is so pure and high that you can't be sustained if you're dwelling in fear, ignorance, limitation.
So what do you think the purpose of the Great Pyramid is?
I see it as an initiation chamber, in a sense. I see that it's actually another pyramid underneath it, so it's really like an octahedron.
Okay,
like
right. I've heard a lot of people suggest that before, and I was wondering whether you thought the same.
So it's actually a platonic solid, and I see that it was what powered the Egyptian society many thousands of years ago, and I see it as a starport. Like at one point that was the center of the world, the beam above the pyramid, and right now the beam is shifted to Jerusalem. So the war in Israel-Lebanon right now is really a star wars about who controls the stargate or the portal above Jerusalem. Out, so what's above Jerusalem and also inside the earth, there's another portal inside. So all this stuff we hear on the news, this skirmish on the land, is just a distraction of the higher intelligences that are operating to control the mathematical electromagnetic grid or portals or stargate around Jerusalem, Stonehenge. Like, they even put a gate, they've even fenced off the Stonehenge now, so that people can't have the access to the memory of the grid, because if you tune into one part of the spider web, you tune into the whole hologram of the spider web.
Yeah.
Every node is connected to everything else. That's what Einstein talked about in higher dimensions, that every node is interconnected to every other node. And that's why I do magic squares with children, because when we draw magic squares, we're doing the grid. That's what we're drawing, is the grid. And then they tune in and make affirmations.
The last question I wanted to ask you was about time travel. Because we've mentioned time travel a few times during this conversation, and I'd like to know, how can you apply your understandings of shapes and numbers to relocating yourself into other points of time and space?
I believe it's a conscious process. Just before I answer it, just quickly, is that some people are aware of an experiment that they did, I think in the 1920s, it was called the Philadelphia experiment, and what they were trying to do was they were trying to make battleships or navy ships invisible so that a ship could go into a foreign port and destroy the enemy. So invisibility was the key military code. And just to cut that story short, the mathematics that they used, which they say came from an alien race, we're not sure, but the mathematics that they were given was based on the Fibonacci sequence. So the Fibonacci sequence, the 2:3:5:8 proportion, was the key to invisibility experiments and therefore time travel. But because of the consciousness of the people had suspicious motives as to why they wanted the secrets of time travel, it went so severely wrong that people got transported into the future. They found bodies embedded in the steel guts of the ship. It was such a disaster because the consciousness wasn't right, because sacred geometry will amplify the consciousness of the inventor. So it all went wrong. So time travel can only happen when you're connected into your heart and into nature, and that your intent, the key word is intent, is pure. So when I go to sleep at night, if I have a problem or let's say I'm doing a mathematical inquiry and I don't know the answer to it, I just put that into my dream space when I go to sleep at night. And in the morning, invariably, I wake up and I just remember, I know I have the solution. So we time travel every time we just go to sleep, in a sense. But can we do it without nodding off and stay conscious so that we can navigate our ways to whether we want to go to the halls of learning or to the living records like the Alexandria libraries? We can go like navigating a ship. So the definition of a shaman is that when a huge tornado is coming and the shaman is ready to become obliterated by the force, the definition of a shaman is that he can go into the spiral, into the eye of the spiral, and steer that hurricane so that he is not consumed, but he becomes part of that amazing energy. So that's what we're all here to learn, because we're here to become shamans in a way, and we can only do that if our heart is pure. Because ultimately I believe that all this sacred geometry that I'm teaching is about embedding that knowledge around the heart. That's what I'm doing. So when say, oh, the golden mean, the Fibonacci has a secret 24 code, I do a lot of work on the inner plane where that 24-ness that I'm excited about, I go within and deal with that around my heart, because everyone's saying, oh, give me the secret, how do I make practical use of this 24 infinite recurring secret? So the people want power and lust and for knowledge, but that's not what it's about. So I can only talk about my access of ancient knowledge is by giving gratitude for the simplicity of all this knowledge in nature.
Well said.
Okay, that doesn't really answer your question.
Well, we've had such a lovely time. Thank you so much for spending your afternoon with me, and for all of the people out there, I hope that you've enjoyed our conversation. Do you think that we got through to the listeners today?
Yes, it's interesting because the topics that we're teaching is a very visual experience, and we've done it, like normally it would go well on a DVD or a visual like TV, but I think if anyone got any knowledge from this, from an audio, oral experience, then I'd be very happy to get any feedback that people benefited just by hearing about it, because we didn't actually do any demonstration on a whiteboard or, so that would be great to know how the message has come across. I love sharing knowledge. I think ultimately I'd like to close on one word. If you ask me what is the essence of sacred geometry, what's it all about, this 1.618 ratio, it's about shareability, because in the end, when I talk about icosa, dodeca and all these frequencies, it's about how wavelengths don't self-destruct to become immortal or infinite. So the key word that I'm talking about is to share, wavelength sharing. So be very, very cautious of people who can't share, because sharing is all about sacred geometry in the end, when we're talking about shapes and how they grow and expand. It's all about shareability. So that would be my key word to end this lecture on, is to remember to share, because that's the summary of all this work. I know it doesn't make sense now, but when we have when we go into a workshop experience and we play with all the geometrical models and we do Vedic mathematics, you'll see that the key word in all of this is the ability to share, because that's what opens up people's hearts.
That's excellent.
I would like to just say thank you for sharing your time and ability to give me an opportunity to just talk about what I'm passionate about. And ultimately, all we're teaching, I think, in the end, is just to follow your own passion as well. If anything from this lecture, if you can understand why to follow your passion, that would be the... that's what charge is all about. We're all hungry for charge, and that's what passion is. So thank you so much, and it's also what I call bliss, so I'm very thankful to you. Yes, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Take good care of yourself, and much, much success on your journey.
Happening.
Okay.
Thank you. I look forward to meeting you all.
Yeah, it'd be great to speak to you and meet you when you get down to Melbourne.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
All right, Jane.
Bye.